Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today, my special guest is Sophia, the creator of 9/11 Mysteries, which I consider to be one of the best DVDs related to 9/11 on the market today. Sophia, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you very much, Jim. I hope you're dynamic.
Well, I tell you, it's very funny, but for reasons I don't entirely comprehend, you and I seem to be among the more controversial figures in the field today. There's a group spearheaded by this fellow Rick Siegel, of course, who has taken grave exception to what you have done with a modest piece of footage from his video, 9/11 Eyewitness, and created such a controversy as to even move to have Google take it down. I told him I thought that was highly inappropriate, and I became the target of criticism, not that I wasn't already in his sight, so there we are.
Right, and it's also interesting that he did not object until December, January of 2006, many months after the video had been released. So I find that curious.
Well, I find many things about this curious, including that I reviewed what I take to have been the second version of your video before the program. And I certainly could not see anything exceptionable from the point of view of the usage of his video. He had a short piece of what he shot from across the Hudson on which you'd imposed, a graph, but it was all clearly identified as having come from his footage. And there was a graph that, as I recall, was about the shock waves from explosions from the building.
That's actually 9/11 Eyewitness's own graph.
And that's 9/11 Eyewitness's own graph.
Yes.
And then later, of course, you use part of his discussion of the pyrocaustic clouds.
Yes, that's not
which
Rick's.
I take it now in yet a new version that you have just completed, you're going to substitute your own discussion of that subject.
Right. The pyroclastic surge material is not Rick Siegel's material. In fact, Rick Siegel didn't make the video 9/11 Eyewitness. Somebody else made it for him. This is the partnership that he is involved in. And it consists of himself, Jim Brewster, and Dave Shaw. And I believe it was Dave Shaw solely, all by himself, who made the video 9/11 Eyewitness. So 9/11 Eyewitness is not Rick Siegel's work at all.
And, it's been a while since I looked at it. I wish I'd also taken a look at it before today, but I'll take another look at it. I remember, though, that it features thermite fairly prominently right off the bat.
Well, honestly, I used material from the very first release. There have been four or five releases of something called 9/11 Eyewitness. Something that I was given back in September 05 was called 9/11 Eyewitness, and then when I contacted Rick Siegel, he was the first one I wrote to for permission, and Dave Shaw, they turned me on to their third partner, Jim Brewster, in Washington State, and Jim sent me a later version, which is the one I excerpted from in the movie, and they were very agreeable with this. Rick did not involve himself in the discussion at all. He was considered the person who lived overseas in Spain, and the other two were the ones who told me they made and had the copyright to the video. I was told many times over by Blue Star Media Group, Jim Brewster, we hold the copyright to 9/11 Eyewitness. And on the video itself, that's what it says. It says Richard A. Siegel and Blue Star Media Group. But I was assured that the business of permissions and all other management of this product was conducted by Blue Star Media Group. So then there was something else that they released later called 9/11 Eyewitness Hoboken. And then there was another one called 9/11 Eyewitness Hoboken TV. And now the newest is 9/11 Eyewitness from Hoboken Festival Cut.
Really?
Yeah, there have been five, to my knowledge, and I have all five copies, but I took from copy number two.
Are there significant differences in these five different versions?
Um, Well, I saw the first one. I saw the second one. The third one, which was the commercial one that they then asked me to sell on my website, I didn't watch that. I don't know exactly how different that one was from the first two. I mean, there are only so many times you can watch the thing. So then the Hoboken TV was something that was actually very artful. It was a one-hour distillation of the original Eyewitness, and there was other material in it, I believe. I watched that, and then they had culled that down to 30 minutes and 10 minutes, and they put all of this on one DVD, intending for people to try to get friends to sit down. If you don't have an hour, watch this 10-minute version and watch this 30-minute version if you want a little more. So I did sell for them at their express request after all of this occurred, all of this problem with Rick, which the other two partners appear not to agree with. They do not have the differences with me that Rick Siegel has, and he has apparently caused them some concern. But at any rate, the Hoboken TV DVD I did sell for them, and then now this festival cut, I've been asked to sell this one as well. And, you know, I'd love to help his partners. I think they're very decent people. It's just unfortunate that Rick is going crazy.
Well, it's bizarre to me what's going on here, because I've been subjected to a very nasty barrage of attacks that are so far beyond the pale that it's hard for me to even discuss them in a, objective fashion. But, you know, reviewing that version of your video, I can't imagine why Rick Siegel would have any problems with what you had done with his material. I don't see any basis for objection at all. I know there was a claim there that you made a substitution in the audio portion where in the original you could hear people oohing and aahing from, you know, across the Hudson in the vicinity where he was filming, and that you put in a very, very faint substitute, a very, very faint audio track where you can hear a siren or something like that, but it's so faint.
Right.
And I mean, I presume it was just to preserve a kind of a continuity in coverage without the distraction of the oohs and ahs. I mean, I didn't see anything a big deal here, but it's been elevated, you know, as though it was some kind of dastardly act by this group of Rick and his friends, whom I can only describe as verbal thugs.
Well, you know, when you make films, there is something that's actually very important called sound design, sound effects, sound engineering. And this was prevalent throughout the 9/11 Eyewitness video, which Rick did not make. The decision to include a long and ongoing broadcast from WINS, a news broadcast, I'm sure people remember that. That broadcast is repeated throughout the video, and it is apparently a kind of backdrop. So technically speaking, that is sound design as well. When you stood on the Hoboken dock, you did not hear the ambient broadcast of WINS. That was inserted into the video at the discretion of Dave Shaw, who made it. So one could say that that's disinformation or not authentic.
If there was something wrong with that to begin with, it was committed in the original as well as your use of it. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Sophia, who created and produced the DVD 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, I must say that if I were to, you know, offer my own, you know, a critique of the second version, which I just watched, it would have nothing to do with the usage you made of Rick Siegel's footage, which seemed to me to be very effective. In fact, I think the whole piece is extremely good in drawing people into the case and getting them to think about it, which seems to me to be the essential function of a documentary of this kind. But I could see where some who are immersed in their own research on different aspects of this could raise questions about the plane footage, or the Jones discussion of thermite, or the discussion about molten metal. Now, in the course of research that's ongoing from Judy Wood, I've been fairly convinced that there's a lot of evidence that suggests maybe those massive pools of molten metal didn't actually exist, but that they were invoked as an explanation for this kind of haze, a residual effect from the use of a high-tech weapon, where the haze was a product of molecular dissociation, but it was so essential to conceal that, that appeal was made to the existence of this molten metal. And independently in assessing Stephen Jones' work on thermite, I've become convinced that he actually has a very, very weak case for thermite or thermate. But on the other hand, you know, I would there's a kind of retrospective fallacy involved in criticizing a work because it isn't as current could be in relation to relatively specialized areas of research. So I would not fault your film on that basis. Moreover, while we have now new and increasingly interesting evidence of video fakery in relation to the planes, especially in this new four-part series called September Clues, which is by far the most impressive work I've seen yet that suggests that the media were presenting a false depiction of events, I think that that's such a subtle and complex business that, you know, to have it as a necessary part of your video would be asking quite a lot. I mean, that's the way it strikes me about all three counts.
Well, again, you know, 9/11 Mysteries was intended to reach a little beyond the parameters of some of the other 9/11 videos. This is why I did hire people from the film and music industry to help me put it together. And we had things like sound design in it because the public is very used to the motion picture that they see in a theater. And when you present to them videos that have been homemade by people who aren't experts in film and film editing and even writing a script for a documentary, the material tends to be shunted aside. So 9/11 Mysteries, the live presentation that Brad and I did in Hollywood, and now this is not Brad Pitt-style Hollywood, okay? This is a progressive theater called the Met Theater, which has been doing very interesting plays mostly for 30 years, and they invited us to do our production, which was simply live narration to video footage. And we presented all aspects of the 9/11 topics. We presented elements from Dave Von Kleist's video. We talked about The Flash. We talked about, at that time, Stephen Jones hadn't emerged, so we did not talk about thermite. And we had four sections to the presentation, which included Hijackers and Planes, War Games, and Who Benefits. And what you see here in this 9/11 Mysteries is just part one, Demolitions. And as I began to put the video together, the DVD version, Stephen Jones had come out with thermite, and many people thought his research was excellent, so we included that. If I ever do Hijackers and Planes, if I ever go that much into a project again, I mean, this DVD it's spreading. I think that's great. But if I do the second one, I'm going to have to mention all the different theories because I feel that's only fair. That's the right thing to do.
Well, there's certainly a lot going on out there. I've got to say, you know, my opinion is that, let me just refer to them, you know, as the gang of thugs, because I really don't know a better way to describe them, that these people really just don't have any comprehension of the nature of publication or creativity. I mean, just to offer a parallel, when I founded the journal Minds and Machines, I had fairly well-developed views about the nature of computers in relation to cognition. In fact, it was ironic. I was editing this journal because my views were that the most prevalent view about the nature of mind, namely that minds are like miniature computers or operate on the same principles as digital machines, are completely mistaken, and that there are fundamental differences between the way in which minds work and the way these machines operate. And yet the prevalent view in the field of cognitive science is that there is a common similarity, that they are actually bound or characterized by the same or similar principles. Now, if I, as the editor, had insisted that only articles be published with which I agree, practically nothing would appear, because the predominant view in the field is one that I was convinced was mistaken, but it was certainly the predominant view in the field, and I and my editorial board were looking for, you know, high quality research papers, not necessarily ones with which we agree. So that it's a completely inappropriate standard to only publish, if you're in the role of an editor, work with which you happen to agree. And this, of course, carries over to books. Because I include articles in a book that I publish, doesn't mean I necessarily agree with everything that's claimed by every author. But I think that they're interesting, important, well-argued, and so forth, that they have the kinds of virtues that make them a worthy contribution to the literature, in this case, for example, the 9/11 conspiracy on 9/11, but not that there's any presumption that further research might not supersede them, or that, you know, maybe the authors themselves are going to eventually conclude change their minds under the impact of new evidence and new hypotheses. I mean, this is characteristic of scientific research in general. Now, it seems to me that we have a kind of a cult-like atmosphere that's developing among this group of 9/11 researchers, which really throws me for a loop, because they fine-tune their beliefs, and if you're not in accord with those beliefs, you are somehow demonized, villainized, and completely repudiated. It's a stunning phenomenon. We'll continue with our conversation with Sophia, my special guest, in a moment. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Sophia, before we continue with this, I've had an inquiry about the origin of the soundtrack that you integrated with the Siegel footage, and whether, you know, had that come from independent 9/11 footage, and see, was it synchronized for time, or was it just derived from other sources?
The siren?
Yeah.
Is that what they're talking about?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, I will call attention to the fact that the radio broadcast in Rick Siegel's original footage was added after the fact, and that in the context of 9/11 Mysteries, our movie, did not fit. It was an extraneous, diversionary kind of added element. It wasn't even a good choice of sound design. So in order to make our audience understand what was going on, we put in one small siren, and there was also a helicopter in Rick's footage, and we added a helicopter noise so that it would all flow together. Because Rick's footage, the audio in Rick's footage is actually very poor. There, you can hear almost nothing. And the fact that he caught those sounds is rather unusual. So when you make a movie, if what you're showing is evidentiary, our rule was don't add any sound design. If it's just filler footage, B-roll, introductory, any of that, then it's okay to augment the feel of the thing by putting in some sound design. You can look at our Final Cut file. We have very little sound design. But we did substitute for Rick Siegel's droning, and I won't say this is Rick Siegel's, this is not his choice, but the person who made the video for him, the droning radio broadcast. Because in the context of our movie, our listeners and viewers would have gone, what? Why are we listening to that radio? What's that all about? In the context of Eyewitness, it is the background sound throughout the movie. And there happens to be a male screaming in 9/11 Eyewitness when the towers fell. And when I was watching Eyewitness, I heard this scream many, many, many times throughout the movie. And I was wondering why it was there. I don't believe that man screamed 6 or 7 times, but it was in there. It was all over the movie. So that's sound design, and that's something that's a distraction. So we put in these two little effects so that the whole thing would feel like you were on the dock watching.
Well, I think the whole assault is so ridiculous and so misconceived, and there's so many more important issues out there that I cannot believe the waste of time and effort that's gone into that. The repeated attacks upon you and me, and they've devolved to such a crude level where they have taken, for example, a photograph of me and imposed clown features over it. I mean, this is junior high school stuff, Sophia.
Well, the question
they imposed a clown image over me, and then they repeated it innumerable times.
Right.
I expect to go to 9/11 researchers now and see nothing but, 100,000 instances of me in clown face. I mean, this is so juvenile.
Okay.
This is so immature. It's so irresponsible. It's so disgusting. It's so discrediting. It makes these people look trivial and childish.
I'm your guest. Can I say something?
Of course.
All right. This is what they want you to do. They want you to erupt in protest and call them names and tell them they're childish. But my question is, how does the addition of a helicopter noise where there is a helicopter, how does that constitute disinformation? How does what I have, the context in which I use 9/11 eyewitness material in my movie, how is that disinformation? How am I hurting the 9/11 cause? That's the question. And how do we build a better world with people who sit at their keyboards and post stuff like this all day long? How do these people help us improve the world? That's my question.
Oh, I agree with you completely.
And since it's obvious that they're not improving the world by doing this, there's no reason to worry about it.
Well, yes. Well, I've made my efforts to have a rational exchange and found it was completely pointless. So that, that's no longer a priority for me.
Right. So, one of the things we were going to discuss today, you were mentioning the cognitive mind and what we are to do with 9/11 as we learn more and more about it. I want to get into the aspect of illusion that was created that day. This whole affair was a giant deception, and the deception was conducted on so many levels. All the false stories put out there, all of the, it was all hocus-pocus, flim-flam, and they got the whole country to believe it. Why? Is the country lazy? Why do people not question this a little bit more? That's what I'm intrigued with.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. I tend to attribute a lot of what I take to be the dumbing down of the nation to the influence of television, that we read less, we watch more. It's a very passive form of mental engagement. It's the lowest level of mental interaction. When you read, you're actually strengthening your mind, but when you watch television, it's the next best thing to being asleep. In fact, some studies have shown that when you watch television, you're in a lower state of mental activity than you are when you're asleep.
Right. And so the effect of a movie like 9/11 Mysteries, I'll give you an example. Somebody called me yesterday. She showed the movie to a group of women friends who are all, fairly well-to-do. And one woman apparently walked up to the TV set in the middle of the movie, right as 9/11 Mysteries was halfway through, turned it off and went into the next room and began to scream.
Really?
Yep. And then she was, the other people went in after her, and she said, "Why are people not talking about this? Why are they not talking about it? What is wrong with America? If this is true, why are people not talking about it?" And I told this to someone else last night who said, "Yes, we should be leaning out of our car windows hollering bloody murder."
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So that I find fascinating. Why the public is so somnambulant, so unresponsive, and I can only conclude as I've been reading books like Behold a Pale Horse by William Cooper, Welcome to the Machine by Derek Jensen, that there is a mass brainwashing, a mind control, a social scripting going on, and we are now seeing the results of it. The results have been very effective. We've got these Stepford people, trudging around who aren't able to comprehend anything, who want their next beer can and paycheck and TV program. That's it.
it's really stupefying when you begin to appreciate the dimensions, because the term sheep has been applied to the populace in general, in that the reaction of most of the nation to a lot of this has been that of the so-called sheeple.
Right.
I know you have some thoughts about this and the differences between the sexes that we want to discuss, but it is acutely disappointing, notwithstanding, however, that some poll results indicate that 9/11 is starting to sink in. I think there's just a sense of helplessness, you know, what can be done? And when you see Democrats having a mandate to get us out of Iraq doing nothing, I think that sense of helplessness is reinforced. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Sophia, the creator and producer of 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, very consistent with the observations you've been making about the dumbing down of our critical intelligence, is a piece by Paul Krugman, a brilliant commentator who writes for the New York Times. If anyone out there goes to 911scholars.org and clicks on headlines, the second item in the headlines is a piece by Krugman entitled Lies, Size, and Politics, where he's just offering some examples of the failure of the press even now to adequately cover the Republican presidential debate, for example, where Mitt Romney, in Tuesday's exchange, completely misrepresented how we wound up in Iraq, and later Mike Huckabee mistakenly claimed it was Ronald Reagan's birthday, and that the Washington Post identified the gaffe of the night as the mistake about Ronald Reagan's birthday. I mean, he's just suggesting that the media really isn't doing any good for the American people in bringing out facts or contributing to critical thinking.
Well, that's right. And if you are right in saying that we have a nation of sheep, how are we going to take back the country by force? So I propose that it's not going to be taken back by force. It's going to be taken back by consciousness. Consciousness being awareness. And that's what I'm inviting the American public to do. Become more aware. This is why 9/11 is so utilitarian. It is actually very much a gift in some ways. Here's an event that nobody missed, although apparently there are people today, if you question them, students, who don't even know when it occurred. They don't know that it was in 2001. It's a little hard to believe, but...
When you say utilitarian, you mean of practical significance,
yes.
Not merely historical.
Yes. I mean, we have an event that we can use as a tool to invite people to awaken to what is going on. This was something that, as I said, didn't escape anyone's notice when it happened. Everybody knew about it. It's part of our jargon. You'll now hear all kinds of people in all kinds of arenas referring to, well, after 9/11, well, after, you know, before 9/11, we did this. After 9/11, we have this protocol.
Yeah.
9/11 was like a turning point. And since it was so big, why can't people look at it fully? They're only looking at a little part of it, which is the official story. And when you show people this thing doesn't add up, here are other ways to look at it, it becomes a very useful tool. And we have to use it as a tool. Otherwise, screwed. What can I say?
Well, something I like about, you know, asking candidates questions about 9/11, the Truth Squad approach, is that it tends to create a moment that the media often captures and therefore contributes to elevating consciousness about 9/11 as a real political issue.
Say that again?
I like the Truth Squad approach. You know,
when
a political era, we have 10 candidates on each side. There are many opportunities for persons who are knowledgeable about 9/11 to ask questions of candidates, which seem to me to create moments that the media often pick up on and that can make contribute to elevating awareness about 9/11.
Well, sure. But again, when you watch September Cruz, all those media people who called in to report that they had seen a plane hit the towers, one has to ask oneself, why was the media calling in? Well, you know what? Maybe they were on their way to work and they knew the number. They had it on speed dial or something, whereas the average citizen would be grappling with, who should I tell this to? What's the news station to call, et cetera, et cetera? But so you have to ask yourself, here were all these people who had this ready script. It's very interesting, don't you think?
Yes, I thought it quite fascinating. Anyone who's gone now to 911scholars.org and gone to headlines, I mentioned the second item in the headlines. This is the very first, September Clues, four approximately 10-minute segments that are offering studies, evidence of media complicity, or at least apparent media complicity in television fakery about these events, and some of the stuff being presented here is quite stunning. As you say, Sophia, the fact that so many of those they were quoting on the air were associated with the networks themselves, all but one, and I'd be willing to make the inference that if we knew more about him, I mean, we're talking about maybe 10 different sources. If we knew more about him, I would be willing to bet he's probably associated with one of the networks, too.
You might win that bet. But again, I know people who were in New York who did see the plane. And I don't think a lot of people saw the first plane because it took everybody by surprise. And I have asked people, are you sure that was a plane? And they have sworn to me that they saw planes. I mean, there are three airports near Lower Manhattan. There's Newark, there's LaGuardia, and there's JFK. So the people who I talked to said they saw planes every day, all sizes, small ones, big ones. And so I find it rather interesting that people are so sure that they saw a plane and nothing else. And then here we have this amazing creation, this night, September Clues, that posits something entirely different. And I believe we should all be open-minded. We should think really hard about this and not exclude things that just don't fit in our reality.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that it's indispensable to have an open mind and be willing to consider alternatives and new evidence. I mean, I've had several guests on discussing, you know, issues related to video fakery and planes, no planes, whatever, and I've certainly found it instructive to look at the footage they've provided. This September Clue seems to me to be more powerful than anything I've seen before, but there's still that gap, that logical gap between video fakery and the absence of planes. I mean, you could have video fakery and the presence of planes where there was something about the planes or the way they interacted with the building that was being concealed for whatever reason. I mean, it's so very difficult to know why things like this are done if you don't actually know what took place. And, of course, you're not going to be able to sort that out unless you're very lucky or have inside information. I mean, I think it's great that there's a lot of attention on video fakery because, as September Clues reveals, there appears to have been quite a lot of it. I don't think it's quite definitive of the planes, no planes issue, however, where I remain myself agnostic. And I mean, initially, it's so difficult to imagine there could have been no planes because there had to be thousands of eyes on the towers at that point in time. There had to be a staggering number of cameras, videos, and all that. And yet, I have seen a lot of what appears to be video fakery, and the question then becomes, well, is any of that video fakery fake video fakery? I mean, this is the level of complexity that we encounter here. The stuff certainly in September Clues looks to me pretty good.
Well, it's certainly well put together, and it makes one think, and that's what we all have to be doing. I don't believe that there's all this wrong and right. I mean, they had years to plan this, whoever planned it. They had everything at their disposal, including all of us being unaware. You know, nobody predicts the future. Some people did. I guess Alex Jones and a few others predicted this event in some way, but we did not know what was going to happen. And then when it happened, you're told, boom, this, you know, snapshot, official story, that's it. And everybody says, all right, well, we're also much reeling from what happened. This is, it's shock and awe. It was a psyop, right?
Yes, I quite agree with that.
After the fact, with the limited ability we have to look for evidence, we have to put this story together somehow, and I think everybody's views are to be entertained.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Today, my special guest is Sophia, who created and produced 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, I suppose there's an awful lot of consensus that Building 7 is one of the true Achilles heel of the official account of the events of 9/11. And I think Building 7 is fascinating because it's so clearly a classic controlled demolition. It has every property of a controlled demolition, and there's no property of a controlled demolition it lacks. We have Larry Silverstein's conversation about telling the fire commander perhaps the best thing to do is to pull it, which is, of course, extremely fascinating in itself, particularly since you couldn't pull a building unless there were previously positioned explosives. And then, and most recently, we have the discovery of the BBC archival footage, which shows and raises the most serious questions about interaction between the media, the intelligence agencies, and the government, of a reporter talking about the collapse of Building 7 at 4:57, 23 minutes before the event occurs.
That's right. I mean, this is where I go again. It's the creation of this illusion. I mean, it did happen. Those towers came down. Building 7 came down. But the story is just a total deception. And I'm saddened that American people they're not curious about it. As you said, they're waking up, which is nice. But if this is a race against time, if in fact, you know, we're going to have some kind of police state in a couple of years, or by 2012, or whenever people project it's going to happen, we have to invite them to open their consciousness quickly. And it has to be done by invitation. It's not going to be done if you hammer them over the head, or insult them, or challenge them to look at this. And these are the methods that many of us are accustomed to using. Parents shame their children to learn, you know.
Well, my surmise is that Bush and Cheney aren't going to relinquish power willingly. In fact, I think they have no intention to relinquish power. It's like the reason we had no exit plan from Iraq is there was no plan to exit, no intention. Now, of course, they're gradually sharing with the American people that we actually have 14 permanent bases under construction there. And the idea is to keep American forces there for 50 years into the future using South Korea is a model, even though it's completely inappropriate. There's a total disanalogy. I mean, we had one nation invading another when the North attacked the South across the 38th parallel. We had a United Nations response. It was all multinational. They were clearly in violation of international law. Our presence there has been welcomed by the South Koreans, and it's been a long-term, mutually agreed-upon relationship. The situation in Iraq could not be more completely opposite. We're an invading force. We're occupying the country. We're resisted. We're opposed by a resistance that is misdescribed as an insurgency, and the Iraqi people overwhelmingly would prefer that we not be there. And I'm hoping, Sophia, that the Iraqi parliament will, pass a resolution to get us out, or simply not pass this first benchmark the Bush administration has made, which is the privatization of the oil, which is what this whole business has been about for the most part in any case.
Well, that's what we're assuming, but it could be about something bigger than oil, you know?
Go ahead.
The idea of nationalism, freedom, it seems to me, from what I've been reading, and I really encourage people to read this book, Behold a Pale Horse. There's also a Google video of Bill Cooper. It's apparently 4 hours long. Somebody sent me the link today. So William Cooper, Bill Cooper, he was a Navy intelligence agent, and he decided to express in this book everything he had learned being an intel agent in the Navy. The perception of people as social energy that is to be shaped. There is natural energy in the world, there is social energy, and economics seeks to control both of them. So our household, our perceptions of nationalism, loyalty, filial love and obligations to our parents and parents' obligations to children, the whole creation of the American way of life, I see now as an experiment. And it is being shattered systematically at the same time as it's being promoted. We are exporting what democracy to the rest of the world when we don't have it here. They spend a lot of energy telling us we're free when we're really not free either. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, of course. I mean, we're ostensibly in Iraq to promote freedom and democracy while simultaneously freedom and democracy are being contracted here in the United States.
I read an email today about people who are trying to take photographs and videos with their cameras in parks and whatnot. They are arrested. They are held on, you know, this is considered wiretapping. How is it wiretapping? When they do it to the citizenry, they're not, you know, they're faultless. But when a person harmlessly takes a photo in a public place, which is apparently something that the First Amendment allows you to do.
One would have thought.
Yeah, then you're strung up by your heels. So the idea that Americans are free, it's sold to them. If you repeat something enough, people believe it. But we're not free. And we are being scripted. And we're being scripted. It's coming to us from all over the place. The media, the education system, the food, the water. Is it an accident? There's aluminum chlorohydrate in our deodorant. It's a neurotoxin, you know. Deodorant is something we use every day. Fluoride in the toothpaste, fluoride in the drinking water. And then you say to yourself, boy, Americans are dumb as rocks. Is it a surprise?
And some suspect that chemtrails may be involved here, too. This is a very mysterious subject, exactly what's going on in the atmosphere. But, you know, there are thousands of photographs of these chemtrail patterns, and it seems very clear something is going on, and it's something the government doesn't want to address.
Well, I took photos of the sky from airplanes the other week when I was aloft. You know, not all of us get the chance to fly, but I'm wondering why people haven't photographed the sky from airplanes. I'll tell you what I saw. The blue-black sky. Remember when you were a kid, you looked up at the sky and it was inky blue? And that's what made me believe that the universe, that space could be black. Because this sky was so deep and so rich in its color. It was almost ultramarine. That's gone. We don't see that. And yet, in the air at 35,000 feet, I could see it. There it was, the blue-black sky, and underneath it, a white belt. A belt of white material. And under that belt of white was this white mist. So we're living effectively in 30,000 feet of white chemical mist. And I photographed that. I have loads of photos of this. You do see the original sky, but what we're living in isn't that. It's white. We have a white world. They are altering our world. Now you ask me, who are they? And here I propose that we don't create this duality. We created them. By being asleep, we allowed them to take the wheel. Now we have to take the wheel back. And we're not going to do it by force. We're going to do it by consciousness, using our noggins, starting now.
Well, who else but the American military would have the capacity to crisscross the American skies without the American military becoming aware of it and responding to it if it were somehow something of which the American military were not approving? They boast how they cover every inch of American airspace with radar 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and this is not something that could possibly escape their detection. So it has to be through complicity with the Air Force that these things are taking place. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Sophia, the creator and producer of 9/11 Mysteries. And Sophia, when you talk about, you know, elevating awareness or consciousness of 9/11, we don't have an infinite variety of alternatives. Some involve the written word, others the spoken word, so that, you know, writing letters, reading books, and so forth are important. But our society, our culture is so visual that it seems to me that DVDs are perhaps our most important means of communicating what we know about 9/11 to the American people and elevating their awareness, which is why I was so distraught to discover that that Rick had intervened to have 9/11 Mysteries taken down from Google, where it obviously belongs. And do I understand 9/11 Revisited has also been the subject to some objection of that kind?
Oh, yes, he had that one taken down, even though it doesn't have any of his footage in it at all. And he also had a few others. I got emails from a number of people, as did the 9/11 Eyewitness website. They got emails complaining that their videos were taken down because of Rick Siegel. So once again, you have to ask yourself, how is this constructive? It's not. And what is the point? You know, if our collective aim is to educate people and videos are that useful, then leave them up.
This is so disheartening. I mean, there are no flawless videos. I mean, if I think about the one that has done the absolute most to elevate awareness about 9/11, of course, it's Loose Change. And Loose Change, you know, is generally right-headed, but it also can use a lot of fine-tuning, which may be taking place, and, well, it's been taking place incrementally and having, you know, a new version, a new cut, and so forth. And presumably, if it makes its way into general theater release, which I dearly hope, but I think cannot be taken for granted, presumably it's going to be in even better shape than it was before. But there aren't any flawless videos. So if we take a kind of, you know, theological approach here, so that if there's anything in a video with which we disagree, then we want to abolish it, abandon it, or condemn it, then I can't see that we have any possibility of communicating what's going on to the American people in a manner that's going to actually succeed in reaching large numbers.
Right. The creation of any video or book involves discretionary choice, right? What am I going to put down? The very utterance of a sentence involves discretionary choice.
That's right. You've got to figure out what words in what order.
Right. And you could say it 10 different ways, but you choose to say it this way because that's all you have time to do. Or that's what your brain decides is the best. So in the creation of any 9/11 movie, you're going to be choosing pieces to put together in a certain way. If somebody objects to the way you put it together, then that's too bad. This is, in my case, I got the permission to do it from Blue Star Media Group. This is how I chose to do it. It wasn't criticized even by Rick Siegel for months. There was a reason that he began to criticize, and it had to do possibly with the success of 9/11 Mysteries. So you have to just ask yourself, what is really going on? Why can't we all work together? I promote the Eyewitness video. I believe it's not a mainstream video, per se, because it's a little bit hard to watch, but there are people who dearly want that bit of, shall we call it, evidence in their collection. It's an important video. This is why I wanted to show it to large numbers of people in the hopes that those people would then go and buy it and add it to their collection. The beauty of 9/11 is, as people become viewers of these videos, they want to see more and more and more. The woman that I referred to who yelled out and locked herself in a room and got very upset a few moments ago, and I talked about that, her thing was, get me more videos. I want to see more. I want to see everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful. That's the response we want. There's enough interest, an audience that's growing by leaps and bounds. There were some 10,000 people a day seeing 9/11 Mysteries on Google. Now multiply that by the days that it's been down, and that's a lot of people who haven't seen it. The tide was suddenly, you know, broken. But it's okay. It'll come back up. And people will see it again. This is just part of the way that human beings interact with one another, it seems.
Well, I'm very dismayed because I look around and, I mean, you have a, you know, 9/11 blogger. I mean, this is just my experience. I had a blog on 9/11 blogger, which was a way of communicating with a lot of people there who have, in my opinion, a very narrow approach toward understanding what actually happened in 9/11. They don't welcome research outside of a very narrow channel. In fact, they fiercely attack anyone who goes beyond the consideration of conventional explosives, thermite and thermate. And since I'm convinced that the case for thermite and thermate has not been made, and that even if they were involved, they can't possibly provide an adequate explanation of the totality of the devastation to the World Trade Center, the degree of pulverization, the speed with which the buildings came down, and all that, I have not been welcomed there, but I've made repeated efforts to explain why we have to be a bit more critical rather than simply buying into an account that may in fact be hopelessly inadequate and easily defeated if it were to be used as the basis for a court case, because there are too many out there who seem to think that we have enough evidence or enough information to take things into court. I don't believe that's remotely the case. But here you have 9/11 blogger has now cut me off completely. I mean, you know, there's no interaction between us at all now. I have no longer any access to blogger. On the other hand, you have this group at 9/11 researchers where I have featured 9/11researchers.com on Scholar's website. I have felt that there was a lot of independent research going on there. They had been generally supportive of Judy Wood, but they've come after me with a hatchet, and I think it's really for no good reason, just as they've been attacking you and me for sticking up for you, because I think you've done nothing inappropriate and that their way of dealing with these issues is completely counterproductive and monstrous. Taking down these videos is god-awful. It's an atrocity, in my opinion. And then we have the Scholars for Truth and Justice group that Steve Jones was the fulcrum for when he and I had this division in our attitudes toward the science and politics of 9/11, which has supported a San Diego grand jury event that has turned out to be a fiasco. I mean, it turns, not only did Don Paul release a statement claiming that they brought indictments against not just the two that were the central focus, but 14 others with this list, including David Rockefeller. But the members of the grand jury, after weeks of protest, put out their own explanation that this was not the case, that they had never even reached the point of deliberations, and that the whole thing appeared to be a hoax. And to me, that is about as serious an offense as could possibly occur in terms of undermining the credibility of the 9/11 movement. So that even somebody in New York approaches David Rockefeller and tells him he's been indicted for murder by a grand jury in relation to 9/11 out in San Diego. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. This is your host, Jim Fetzer, on The Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is Sophia, the creator and producer of 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, I mentioned the San Diego grand jury where Don Paul and Jim Hoffman played the most important roles. The grand jury itself was put together by a fellow named Mike Mopass, who's going to be my guest tomorrow. I should mention that I had invited Don Paul to be on the show on the 17th. And he had notified me a few hours before the program was scheduled that he had a work conflict and couldn't come on. In the meanwhile, then I've had John McCarthy, who was a member of the grand jury, who was very outspoken in his condemnation of the failure of the process and the false claims being made about the product, and that the jurors never had the opportunity even to deliberate. So I just want everyone to know, if they're interested in that, which seems to me to be an issue of enormous importance to the 9/11 community, tune in tomorrow, because Mike Mopass will be my guest. But another issue that seems to me to be, transcend questions about whether or not these videos, Loose Change, 9/11 Revisited, 9/11 Mysteries, which seem to me to be the three most successful in drawing in, our fellow citizens and elevating consciousness or awareness of these problems, is that this Scholars for Truth and Justice claims to have filed a request for correction with NIST following the lead blazed by Jerry Liepart and several members of Scholars, Judy Wood, Morgan Reynolds, but also Ed Haas, of the Muckraker Report, where Jerry had the insight to realize that the Data Quality Act could provide a framework for exposing the corruption of the NIST's completely unscientific investigation of 9/11. I still believe it's our greatest hope for actually making some kind of legal impact on the case. And the Scholars for Truth and Justice, with great fanfare, claimed not only that they had had the idea first, but that they had their own request. And they publicized it widely, and yet it hasn't shown up on the government's website, which in my opinion raises serious questions as to whether all of this was merely feigned. I mean, is it real or is it not? Because it ought to be there. Now, those kinds of issues, this NIST, this request for correction, and the San Diego grand jury seem to me to be of enormous importance. And yet we have this group, this gang, as I refer to them, focusing on relative or comparative trivialities about whether you did or did not add a soundtrack to Rick Siegel footage. And it seems to me the comparison is just so blatant, and it's so irresponsible for this gang to be making so much out of so little. When if you impose a standard of perfection on any video, none would ever be produced, because none of them are ever going to attain that high standard. In fact, all we can ever ask, and this is true of practically every decision we make in life, is whether it was good enough.
Well, it's not about perfection. It's not about standard. It's about the protocols of movie making. The video 9/11 Mysteries was not intended to go in front of a court. It was intended to convince an audience that the government story of 9/11 was not true. And Rick Siegel's, I don't know how many times we use Rick Siegel's footage. It's repeated more than once. But I believe wherever it's used as evidence, we have not doctored a single thing. When we bring in Hoboken the doc, yes, we've made a little postcard. And he objected to that. It doesn't matter what I do to 9/11 Eyewitness. The very fact that it's in the movie 9/11 Mysteries is an irritant to Rick Siegel. So I could give Rick Siegel $1 million tomorrow if it's money that he's after, and that wouldn't make him happy.
Well, you know, my attitude couldn't be more opposite, because I think all of us need to use whatever resources are available to us to advance the 9/11 movement. And even if one were to have differing views about some of what is emphasized in your film, as I say, committing perhaps the retrospective fallacy, given just for illustration that I'm rather persuaded by Judy's arguments that probably the molten metal, the massive, you know, molten metal mountain there beneath the surface probably didn't exist, I wouldn't fault your film on that basis. I mean, I would say, you know, maybe an updated version, perhaps by a different filmmaker, would present a different case. But so what? I mean, either you've done enough to draw in your viewers so that they're contemplating the issues without being the last word. You know, it seems to me you make that very clear, particularly at the end of your film. You make it very clear that your film is intended to raise issues and not to be the final judgment.
No, that's right. I mean, I'm not going to keep remaking 9/11 Mysteries. I have other things that I'd like to do in my life. So there are other people who are welcome. Why doesn't Rick Siegel make his own movie, really his own movie, with his own narration and his own views? I mean, anyone's welcome to do that. There's any room for any number of 9/11 videos. So there's no reason to, you know, tell the world that this thing should be taken down because it's disinformation. 9/11 Mysteries is not disinformation because it has sound effects in it here and there. How is that disinformation? So anyway, we can go back to the consciousness issue, which is my favorite issue. I really think that this world needs to change in some serious ways. And that those changes have to start with the individual. We have to stop being victims.
Well, my perception is that it has a whole lot to do with the role of corporations in society, that what we have emerging here, is, and it's been a long time coming, is a is a blend of big government with big business, a form of organization of society typified in this case by nationalism and militarism, where the leader tends to be identified with the state, and any criticism of the leader is treated as unpatriotic or even treasonous. Mussolini described this as corporatism, but said it could equally well be defined as fascism, and I think that's where we are today. We have an emergent American-style fascist form of government.
Right, and according to William Cooper, that was the intent all along, the thesis, antithesis, synthesis. We're getting fascism as the synthesis. Let me go, I can find it in my notes. Democracy, first in World War I, monarchism was thesis, faced democracy, which was antithesis, resulting in the formation of communism and the League of Nations, synthesis. So World War II, we have democracy and communism, thesis, facing fascism, antithesis, resulting in a more powerful United Nations, synthesis.
Well, just to comment very generally about what you're describing, roughly this is a kind of a Hegelian dialectic in history. I don't happen to subscribe to it, but it can provide a useful framework for discussing some of these matters. When you talked about the potential for a military police state emerging by, I think you were suggesting 2010 or 2012, my great concern is that Bush and Cheney are not going to be willing to relinquish power, and things are going to happen far, far faster. I could see, for example, another false flag operation occurring just before the election next November, which would be stretching it out as long as possible in order to then use that event to justify suspending the Constitution and putting the country under military control. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back with my special guest, Sophia. My special guest today is Sophia, who is the creator and producer of 9/11 Mysteries. Sophia, I got to say, this morning I was exercising and listening to Air America, and I was kind of struck. I think Rachel Maddow may have been on this morning, though usually it would be Stephanie Miller, but someone was commenting on both 9/11 and JFK, and the remarks they were making about JFK seemed to me to be, you know, appropriate and well taken, and they started talking about 9/11 and three buildings coming down on the same day and saying about Building 7, and they started talking about this physics professor from BYU who'd established that thermite, you know, had been used in bringing them down. And I just was thinking about that. Well, you know, I said to myself, that's going to get a lot of people interested in this. And just because the first thing they hear about it concerns something, you know, a mode of destruction that I think is only partial and incomplete at best, and maybe misleading at worst, it's nevertheless going to have this effect of getting people interested, elevating their consciousness, making them more aware, as you say. And I just don't see that as a bad thing. I mean, to get people aware one way or another is a good thing. Now, I'll grant that you may, you know, eventually to bring them to a higher level of understanding, we may have to go in, you know, maybe a much more elaborate process. But I just thought it was so ironic, you know, particularly we were going to be talking today, that here this was on Air America, and normally, you know, the 9/11 truth movement would think this was a great thing, a giant step in the right direction, and yet I know there are multiple groups out there who are going to be appalled that it even took place.
Right. Well, we can come in through any different, any number of different ports or portals into this 9/11 picture. Some people come in through the Pentagon. For other people, Building 7 is the issue. For me, it was what a pilot had said, a U.S. Air pilot that I knew. He just said there's no way that you could fly a plane into a building like that. He said I couldn't do it with all my experience, and that's 30 years of flying Boeing. And I just, to me, that didn't make any sense. So we can be invited in by our own curiosity through any different number of any number of different doors.
Access routes, yes.
And that's important, because then as you awaken and you're curious, you want to learn more and more and more and more. And eventually you're going to form your own theory. You're going to say, okay, this thing I don't know about, but here's something that definitely can't be dismissed. And that's the beauty of this whole grassroots phenomenon. No matter what anyone says about any one work, when you look at a meadow of wildflowers, the whole thing is in bloom, and that's what we should be focused on with 9/11. We want everybody to be in bloom around this thing.
Well, if you were going to recommend, you know, two or three things that people can do to benefit the nation with respect to 9/11, what would those things be?
Well, first of all, I think we should be talking about this. We should not be whispering to our friends and relatives that something was awry about 9/11. We should be out there discussing it. We should be engaging in dialogue, in the exchange of ideas, fearlessly, publicly. We should be looking to our local representatives for what they think, and they should not be afraid to comment and question. I mean, why are we tiptoeing and scurrying around in the shadows? So that's one thing. The second thing is narrowcasting, the one-to-one transmission of information, as opposed to broadcasting, which is information coming from centralized hubs, where it is, you know, sanitized and scripted and follows a certain agenda. So people trust what's told to them by people they respect. And we need to be doing that, spreading the information one-on-one. So each of us, I've created now the 9/11 activist kit on my website, avatarproducts.com, 9/11mysteries.com. You can go to the store. And the activist kit is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. I've got the 9/11 fact sheet postcard. I printed 100,000 of them. 75,000 are in circulation now in 6 months. These are 7-cent postcards. So you can pass this. The public likes stuff that's shiny. They like things that are that look commercial. So what we have to do in 9/11 is we have to start producing information bits that look and feel commercial, because that's what they're used to. They're used to reading glossy magazines. So what we give them has to be glossy. Otherwise, they're going to think somebody did it in a back bedroom and it's not true. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
So we have to commercialize our message. Unfortunately, this has to become a message that is sold, just the way all the counter-information, the propaganda has been sold to us. We don't have television stations, but we have to do our best. This is why I produce my DVD at $3 a pop in the slim pack, so people can buy it in bulk from me. It's a factory pressing, and hand it out, because it has more viability than a silver disc that you write on with a Sharpie. So, sorry, go.
Well, no, I was just going to add, I would encourage everyone out there who has copies of any of these DVDs to go to their public access community television in their neighborhood, in their community, and see if you can get them put on. Write letters to the editor and to your representatives and senators. And if you have the chance to get into a political setting with a candidate, ask him questions about Building 7 or 9/11, anything that you feel comfortable, that you know enough about to raise the question and feel confident that you can hold your own. I think those are all worthwhile things to do. The more that these, and of course, arrange 9/11 events. Those can be terrific if you have a suitable setting where you can invite speakers or show DVDs, some combination that can be very effective and be a form of outreach, or form a small group that, you know, meets to discuss 9/11, perhaps reading books, watching DVDs, whatever. Those all seem to me to be appropriate. I presume you'd endorse them as well.
Well, of course. Get a rub-on tattoo, for God's sake. Express your faith. Ask me about 9/11. Or get a permanent tattoo. You know, we have to become walking advertisements. We have to wear the T-shirts and the caps. I was thinking, what can I put on a dog? Can I do a dog leash that has, like, little letters, ask me about 9/11? Something where you can be in public and the message is out there. I have license plate frames that I sell for $6 a piece, because those are rubbed 20 times a day. And one of them says, how did the Twin Towers come down so fast? And I want people behind me in a car to scratch their heads and say, yeah, how did the Twin Towers come down so fast? So it's about putting the questions out there. If you expose them enough times to the question, then one of these days they're going to start turning on.
Where again can you obtain copies of these things, like the license plate and so frame and so forth?
911mysteries.com. Just go to the store.
911mysteries.com.
Click on the store. That's it.
911mysteries.com, and there's this store is right there at the 911mysteries.com site. Well, Sophia, I hope your video gets back up on Google. I'm very upset that it's not there now. If 9/11 Revisited isn't there now, it should be, and I would, you know, ask anyone who has any influence about these things that, you know, think about it, because it's only in the best interest, I think, of getting the truth to the American people. It's not necessarily the final truth, not necessarily the whole truth, but enough to get people concerned about 9/11. That's the hook, getting them involved, engaged. And we don't have to approach this as though we're taking a litmus test to belong to a secret society or a cult or some religious, as though this were a religious movement. We're trying to figure out what happened. It's going to happen in bits and pieces. It's not going to be complete. It's not going to be finished. We've got a lot of research to do. Sophia, I want to thank you for all your contributions and for coming on the show today.
Thank you. And I want to thank Rick Siegel for making me so terribly popular.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host of A Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest has been Sophia. Thank you all for listening.